Blog Talk Radio.
Millions of young people grow up in the sunlight of opportunity. But that is another America. And this other America has a daily ugliness about it that transforms the buoyancy of hope into the fatigue of despair. In this other America, millions of people find themselves walking the streets in search for jobs that do not exist. In this other America, millions of people are forced to live in dilapidated, substandard housing conditions where they do not have wall-to-wall carpet, but where they all too often have wall-to-wall rats and roaches. In this other America, thousands of young people finish college or high school rather every year, reading at an eighth grade or ninth grade level, not because they are dumb, not because they don't have native intelligence, but because the schools are so inadequate, so overcrowded, so devoid of quality, so segregated, if you will, that the best in these minds can never come out. And I guess the most critical problem in the other America is the economic problem. For in this other America, we find some 40 million of our brothers and sisters perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. Unemployment is still wide in the black community, and I need not pause to give the figures. They are before us every day. Now, unemployment is not the only problem. Underemployment is just as great or even greater. For most of the poverty-stricken people in our country are working every day, but they are making wages so inadequate that they cannot begin to function in the mainstream of economic life of the nation. They are working in many instances full-time jobs for part-time income. Now, because of this economic deprivation, that is a great deal of bitterness, a great deal of despair, a great deal of anger on the part of millions of people in the other America. Somehow we must find the causal basis. Everybody knows that, or who knows me, knows that I'm committed to nonviolence, and I still believe that nonviolence is the most potent weapon available to the Negro in his struggle for freedom and justice. But it is not enough for me to say that. It is not enough for one to stand up and condemn a riot. It is just as necessary for people of goodwill and concern to vigorously condemn the intolerable conditions that continue to exist in our society.
Welcome to Tribe Family Channel, Voices of Wisdom, hosted by civil rights activists of the historic Tougaloo Nine, Mrs. Geraldine Hollis and Mr. Joseph Jackson Jr. I am Beverly Black, and I am instead for Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, away on hiatus. Today's speaker is Mr. Floyd Davis, founding director of the Poor People's Campaign, Inc., incorporated in the state of Illinois. The topic, the Poor People's Campaign Remembered. You can call in at 347-539-5285, or you can listen online at blogtalkradio.com/gumbo for the soul. About the Tougaloo Nine, at 11 a.m. on March 27, 1961, nine students from the historically black Tougaloo College walked into the all-white Jackson, Mississippi Public Library. Joseph Jackson Jr., their leader, approached the circulation desk. The rest is history. Voices of Wisdom is so named to keep the voice of Rachel Berry alive through our platform. She created the group Voices of Wisdom because everyone knows something that someone else needs to know, officially known as the Vow Network on Facebook. You can visit us at facebook.com/groups/ the Voices of Wisdom Network. Tribe Family Channel is a Gumbo for the Soul international family brand created by Beverly Black, yours truly. And please help me welcome Mr. Joseph Jackson Jr. Hello, Mr. Jackson. How are you?
Well, hello there, Ms. Black. I am fine, and I'm just excited, really, about participating on this important topic, actually about the Poor People's Campaign Remembered by my role model, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who has always been a part of my life, and being a minister, he was the one that set the example in terms of the type of minister that I wanted to be, and that is to minister to God's people, especially the poor. So I'm honored to be a part of this radio show.
Well, we definitely appreciate your service in civil rights and that of not only your role models, but your mentors whose mantle you continue to carry and the voice of change that you are and continue to be on Voices of Wisdom. Now, we're going to have a lengthy introduction about Mr. Floyd Davis. I say lengthy because, you know, when you have given much, there's much to be said. And not to cut his information short, but to give people a overall view of who we have in our company. So at this time, we are going to listen to an introduction of Mr. Floyd Davis, and we will be bringing him on the line immediately following.
Mr. Floyd Davis. Floyd Davis began his first foray into community activism beginning in 1966. Marching to protest unsanitary conditions in supermarkets that serviced his community. His actions follow a long tradition in his family dating back to the 1800s with his great-great-grandfather, P.J. Gaines, who was a founding trustee of the Snow Hill Normal and Industrial Institute in 1893. Another family member and first cousin, Vivian Malone, was a pioneer in breaking the color barrier at the University of Alabama and the first African American to graduate from the university in 1965. From the civil rights era on to the fight for equality on the economic front with the push for minorities to get union jobs with the Chicago Plan, signed in 1970 through the political turmoil of the 1980s. He has consistently took a stand for progress and change. During the decade of the 1980s, he organized as a Republican in his community and served as ward coordinator in the 5th and 7th wards in Chicago. Never one to shy away from controversy, today as a founding board member of both organizations below, which I will read, he has led the charge for peace in the African American community through a citywide coalition to address violence, poverty, and housing. In 2003, the Poor People's Campaign, Inc. As a founding director of the Poor People's Campaign, Inc., incorporated in the state of Illinois, this 501c organization was dedicated to illuminating Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s original concept of the second phase of the civil rights movement, which drew attention to poverty across the color line and creating economic engines in the impoverished areas of the United States. Today, more than ever, Dr. King's plan to address poverty is a cornerstone in revitalizing urban America. In September of 2012, Floyd Davis was recognized for his dedication of service by President Obama by receiving the Drum Major of Service Award as a testament to his work in Chicago over the years. Ladies and gentlemen, live on Tribe Family Channel, Voices of Wisdom, it is our honor, privilege, and pleasure to welcome Mr. Floyd Davis.
Good evening. Good evening. How are you?
And howdy, favorite. How are you?
Good, good. First off, I'd like to thank you for being afforded the opportunity to be a part of this discussion, especially with one of our pioneers, Dr. Jackson, and his fight for human rights during the civil rights era and beyond.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. I am really just as honored to also be able to interact with another brother also who was involved in the civil rights movement for our people. When we first really connected on the phone, you called me, and we had a brief conversation about Black history and other interesting subjects about our people. And I just really am grateful that you consented to be a guest on our program, that program of me and my producer and host of the show, Miss Beverly Ann Black. So I extend really the appreciation for your acceptance.
Oh, yes, sir. It's definitely an honor. It's definitely an honor. And to think here we are in 2020, still talking about the things and the issues that affect our community as we did 100 years ago in 1919, in that red summer.
Well, exactly. You know, and someone asked me, well, brother, you know, you're a pioneer in the civil rights movement. What are your thoughts about the recent deaths of Brother George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and now Rayshard Brooks, you know, and then, of course, with the civil unrest that really went far beyond 15-plus days. And the question was, what are your thoughts about what's going on now? And I just frankly had to tell that particular person, I really have no thoughts about it. Because what we're dealing with now, and I'm 83 years old, I was involved in the same kind of commitment to racism and prejudice and discrimination 59 years ago when we, under the leadership of my mentor, Mr. Medgar Evers, stepped into that whites-only library 59 years ago in the capital of Mississippi, which was Jackson. I just don't have no feelings about it because, it's the same old record, the same old social restraints, social instances that has always seemed to never, ever really get any better with regard to the social conditions of our people. So I just, and they looked at me, oh, you don't have nothing to say about it? No, this is the same old playbook. What are your thoughts?
Well, it seems to be a never-ending cycle. As far as in the 20th century, it's been a 50-year cycle. I mean, we had the Red Summer of 1919 with the racial violence and a pandemic. You know, in April 1919 in Jenkins County, Georgia, churches were burned and black people were killed. And in the coming months, Philadelphia, Washington, New York, Chicago, they all exploded. These were cities where African Americans had migrated to in hopes of a better future. And in 1921, we saw the destruction of the Black Wall Street in Tulsa. 1923, we saw the destruction of Rosewood in Florida. Every 50 years, it's as if we have an uprising for the same condition for generations to combat the injustices that our people have been subjected to in this country since we came over here in 1619. There's no change. The greatest upswell of even talking about our civil and human rights was 50 years after those times in 1919 where Dr. King came through. 50 years after that, we're right back at the same place. Cities are burning, stores are being looted, unemployment is high, failed school systems, poor health care,
food lines,
crime and violence, drug abuse, terrible housing, and these are all branches on a tree, and the root of that tree is poverty. And as long as we try to attack, the branches, we're not getting anywhere. We've got to go in and water that root. We've got to address the issue of poverty. You know, it's no secret that our communities have been disinvested since time immemorial. For example,
right,
here in Chicago,
right,
we've seen close to $10 billion development over the last, say, 20 years. But on the south and west sides of Chicago, there are still vacant lots that were there from the riots in the 60s. But we see Starbucks, we see Dunkin' Donuts, and we see the other major corporate business coming to the community and say, well, we're doing something to help the community. We're providing jobs, 10 jobs, 20 jobs. But 10 or 20 jobs is not going to change a community. You know, we've got to get back to that old concept where Dr. King talked about co-ops. You know, this is generationally neglected areas across this country. And you got these multi-billion dollar corporations that come in and feed off our people again, like parasites. And they all holler, we want to help. How can we help? We want to do better. You know, well, then let's do co-ops. 50% of that store that comes into that community is owned by the community, and 50% is owned by the corporate establishment. 50% is on the Starbucks. 50% is on the McDonald's. This is the only way we're going to be able to bring dollars and create economic engines so that we can fund our smaller businesses ourselves.
Who's listening? I mean, that sounds like an ideal plan in terms of resolving the problem, the social problem. It sounds like a reasonable solution, but I know how bureaucracy works because I worked for one for 30 years as a Los Angeles County Deputy Probation Officer. And by me, you know, really being a part of that bureaucracy, the county was receiving money, which I could not understand, or they were receiving money from the federal government to keep black and brown juveniles. I was a juvenile investigator, and I saw the socialized racist implementation that was there. And then, of course, it was like I was only being involved in black and brown juveniles, very few juveniles who were white were detained. And what was happening is that the federal government said, well, you know, we will give you revenue to just withhold those minors in custody up to the time that they are to go to court, which is 72 hours. And we, of course, as the deputy probation officers, we had the authority to release minors or cite them out and or detain those that their prior arrest history, in addition to the offense, qualified for them to be detained. And then when the when I went to my supervisor, this was like 95 or 96, when this change of policy was implemented. And when I would go to my supervisor and would recommend that this minor would be released according to his prior arrest history, there are no violent offenses on this record. And then the supervisor said, well, just send him to court. And then I said, well, yeah, but, you know, you see his record. He really should be released. No, just send him to court. To make a long story short, I found out that following year, whether it was 95 or 1996, Mr. Davis, L.A. County received $28 million from the federal government as a result of the change from the mission statement of the probation department, you know, with regards to rehabilitation and working with the community and all of that. And so it just really took the decision-making process out of my hands. And I had always, before this happened, used my profession as a ministry. Because first and foremost, working in those sheriff stations and police stations, the kids that predominantly were detained were the blacks and the browns. And I just I just couldn't believe that the county was making money off of disadvantaged black and brown kids by just keeping them up to the designated time to go to court, which was within 72 hours. And that, to me, really was just a form of slavery, Mr. Davis.
Well, yes,
because,
we know.
Because the more kids that they held in custody, blacks and browns, I was so disgusted, I just had to counsel the kids and to just let them know, look, man, I've done the very best that I can in terms of reviewing your records. All of you guys, you know, are not criminals. And I've done the best that I could, but I no longer have any kind of decision-making authority to release you and to do what I have been doing in the past. And so the county is making money off of you guys. And if you really really want to continue to a profit-making source for the county, just keep coming in here. Because that's exactly what's going on, and I just want to be up front with you guys. You know, they're taking, you know, the decision-making process out of my hand. But I never accepted that in terms of what was going on, because I saw that they were making, the county was making money, a profit off of these young juveniles. And it was just a form of, it looked like it was a form of slavery to me.
Well, the prison system itself is just an extension of slavery. As soon as slavery was abolished, according to the 13th Amendment, except for punishment of a crime, we saw in the South, that's when the prisons exploded. They come up with all type of black laws and this laws and these laws, Lauderman laws, vagrancy laws. They come up with anything they could to incarcerate African Americans in large numbers in order to work the farms and the lands. The only thing now is you're convicted. So this is the work that you have to do. It's an extension of slavery. And these days, the prison industrial complex is a multi-billion-dollar industry, and that's including the federal government. The federal government has one of the largest corporations, and if I'm not mistaken, it's on the stock exchange, Unicor. This is the company that all federal prisoners that work in the jobs inside those federal institutions, you know, this is a multi-billion-dollar industry. They make everything from coaxial wires to the mailbags to furniture to, I mean, anything you can think of. Brooms, office supplies, file cabinets. All these products are being made by federal prisoners and sold on the free market. I remember reading an article back, maybe 10 years or so, where the textile industry in Southeast Coast, I think it was South Carolina, were complaining that they couldn't make money because the federal Unicor system was underselling everybody. But of course they could. They're not paying anything out. So, you know, we have to understand, you know, yes, this slavery is abolished, except punishment for a crime. And as long as we've missed that except, then we fall into the same trap. Back to date, we got a large population of, 2.3 million. The United States incarcerates more people than any country in the world. And the greatest portion of those are people of color. But when they serve their time, they use this word recidivism. They say recidivism. They keep coming back. Well, when you release them into a community that's as dry as a desert, and there's no income, there's no jobs, there's no opportunities for them to change their life, then of course they're going to revert back to their activities that sent them into the prison. And that's the vicious cycle that society has put them in. Because without poverty, then there couldn't be a criminal justice system. There couldn't be an explosion of prisons. You know, when you look at the prison system, how they're made up, most prisons in this country are built in rural areas. And when they build their prison, they got to build hotels, gas stations, restaurants, and everything else. Now, that misery that the people are under inside those institutions is providing the income for the community that's imprisoning them. And for the most part, again, those are in rural areas. So who benefits from our misery at every turn?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was surprised to know, and this, of course, I believe it continues. This cycle, this prison cycle, continues to perpetuate the social ills of poverty. Now, I have one young man that I've adopted as my spiritual son because I am so proud of how he has not only have gone through the juvenile system, he lives in Long Beach. He grew up in Long Beach, I would say. And he was a member of the noted gang, the Insane Crips. And he said that he and his homeboys just used to ride around in Long Beach just deciding what to get into. And they were all packing. Well, as a result of that, he then graduated from the juvenile court system on into the prison system. But he served about 5 years there and finally was released. But when he told me that when he was released, he could not apply for food stamps. He could not, because of his, the criminalized label of a felon, he could not really qualify for public housing, and especially when he began looking for employment, he never, ever was hired. And he just explained to me that if it was not for some gentleman overlooking the box where it said felony, gave him a chance of employment. And he has been doing well working with other men who are released from prison, helping them to get jobs. He is a service-minded person. He's committed to others who have met his same fate. And I was just wondering, as what you just said, how does one who have paid their debt to society are released from prison and their poverty is staring him in the face because all of the avenues to try to really rehabilitate him and socialize him back into the mainstream of society, he is prohibited or restrained from those rights that he deserved to have. poverty in the face. And he said that's what they all do.
Right.
Is that
they
correct?
Have no other choice. And there are a million stories of individual success stories of formerly incarcerated inmates that come into society. But as a community in America, we have to address corporate America and the issue of poverty.
Mm.
We have to go back. I think we got so mixed up in philosophies and different ideas and things that we forgot that the beginning of this whole thing, this movement, that our first great success was stopping the money. When we had the bus boycott, you stopped the money. So the bus company had to say, and the city had to say, wait a minute, this is about dollars and cents. We've got to come to agreement. Is it really that important that our racist views that this black person has to sit in the back of the bus? Are we going to continue to lose this money? So they had to concede. Now just say, if African-American community in America today was still speaking with that one voice, as it was when we had the blessed and that special spirit of Dr. King here among us. Just think, if all across America we said we're not buying any more McDonald's, any more Burger King, Wendy's, the Starbucks, none of the Fortune 500 stuff in the black community until you come to the table and talk about how we can have ownership. Ownership where we can have a chance, equal footing to get our people and get our community back on track. Right now in our community, the money doesn't circulate. The money goes out. We've got the Asian community making money with the beauty shop and the nails and the hairs. You've got the Indian community or the Arab community with the gas stations and the supermarkets. You know, all that money, when they close up business at night, is gone out of the community. It's not like it was in the old days where we had our own network of businesses. You had the man that fixed the TV. You had the barber. You had the shoe shop. You had everything. But that money circulated because he hired or she hired someone from that community to work that store. So the money circulated. And we wonder today why we go through the African-American community throughout the country and we see just blocks and blocks of abandoned storefronts and abandoned buildings because the money's leaving out when the sun goes down. We have to address this on a larger scale. We've got to attack this today. We've got to – Dr. King left us the blueprint. You know, I get so sick of people talking about Dr. King was a dreamer. Dr. King was not a dreamer. He was a master strategist, okay?
Mm-hmm.
He had a strategy behind everything. And what he told us was first, and the first message he showed us was the power of stopping the money, and the last lesson he laid down was the Poor People Campaign to try to get the money and spread it evenly and equally across this country. He said, because if you don't, in 30, 40 years, you're going to see uprisings like you've never seen. And we're seeing it. Look at the violence in our community. We're turning on each other for want of everything. What's ironic to me, with sociologists know and have been knowing this for generations, but during this COVID virus, all this downtown major areas around the country being closed down, and that means there's not no garbage being produced for these dumpsters overnight. And then noticing how the rats are turning on each other. The alpha rats are eating the newborns. The alpha rats are turning on the other males and females. Well, we all know that if it's not enough,
right,
it's going to be a scramble for the food. Now think about that as a people. Is this not a form of genocide? When for generations our people have been denied the opportunity for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, we've got to look at this in a different way. especially.
Well, I'm going to be honest. Yeah. Go on. Go on.
With the debt that this country owes to Africa. It was an African country in 1777 that issued a proclamation stating that the 13 colony ships have the right to ports of Morocco. In 1786, it was the Moroccan-American Friendship Treaty that was signed, the longest-running treaty in history. It is still in effect to this day. So, with America owing so the legitimacy of the 13 colonies, the very legitimacy of the government, was first recognized by an African country. How many of our people know that? The government
knows. I didn't
knows
know it until you had that discussion, that first discussion
President
that
Obama,
we had when I called you.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
President Obama did a speech in Morocco, and he talked about that history. But they didn't cover it in the media in America. They covered it on the BBC. They covered it around different parts of the world, but the media here in America didn't cover it because they don't want us to know the real history. They want us to believe that history began with Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass, and you were slaves, and this is how you fought to get out of slavery. But what about our glorious past? What about our glorious past? It was the Africans that took civilization up into Europe and created the baths and taught them about agriculture and hygiene. And they left it. They walked away from the lessons when Europe was hit with the Black Plague. So we have to understand history. You know, as long as our people are taught from the youngest ages in school that you come from a slave nation, that does more damage to the psyche of every generation of young kids that come out of school, because they come out of that feeling like losers. You're being taught that your people were losers. That's why you got statues of Teddy Roosevelt standing up on the horse with Indian on one side and African American on another, because that's the image that's been perpetuated. We have to demand that they teach the real history, because Africa, what they say, Black history is world history, if you really want to get down to it. World history. Black history. Where's the land of Black? Every people is known by the land from which they come, and it deals with not continental designations, but national laws and governments in the affairs of men and nations. We have to start calling. First of all, we've got to start educating ourselves on international law and what some of these treaties mean. And then at the same time, we have an obligation to go back to Africa and to countries in Africa for assistance. Every other people do it in America. You got the Irish Americans, they got support from Ireland. Mexican Americans, German Americans, they got so many associations. Every people's got an association. And they fly high. But as long as we keep our thinking and our strategy and our minds between the Atlantic and the Pacific, that's all they want us to think about. Don't worry about outside. Outside the East Coast, don't worry about it. Outside the West Coast, leave it alone. Stay within the boundaries of the Atlantic and Pacific. When we've got to get beyond that.
You're absolutely right because for the first time in our family's history, my son, I had the opportunity to visit Kenya for about 3 weeks. And when he returned back home, he said, "Dad," he said, "I just have experienced really the amazing shock of my life." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "When we first, me and his female companion, boarded the plane out of New York to Kenya," he said, "there was several African stewardess
right.
on the plane. Not only that, black pilots. He said it took him a while to just really adjust his psyche. Then he said when they landed in Kenya and saw all of this sea of blackness, he said, really, when he returned back here to America, he said that was a lesson that he learned just from his travels, knowing that he would never, ever read such of an experience in our history books in America. I mean, to see his people.
That's right.
You know? And he hasn't been the same since. That's what you're saying, you know? Once
that's
you
what we did.
Really get out of this country and travel abroad. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's absolutely 100% correct. Once you broaden your vision, you know, we're here like a horse. You know what they put the blinders on the horse, and all you know how to do is just hold that one rope. Don't worry about nothing else outside this rope here. But see, we got to take the blinders off, man. We got to take the blinders off and realize that we're not here alone. We got a whole continent of people that will help us if we start dealing with things in the affairs of men and nations. This is human rights we're talking about. The whole world is up in arms now. They ain't talking about civil rights. They're talking about human rights, how we are being deprived of our human rights in this country. This
mm-hmm.
argument needs to be in front of the United Nations. It needs to be in front of the United Nations.
Well, you know,
the United States is not going
to
address it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's what I'm sure you remember seeing the documentary, of Malcolm X when he came
yeah.
from Africa and he said he was going to go to the United Nations because the United Nations is talking about, human rights. Against other countries, but they never have mentioned about the United States being in violation
right.
of human rights. Malcolm said it's not a question of civil rights. He said it's a question of human rights.
Absolutely.
And that was a result of his travels in Africa. So that is what you are saying now. About now, it's a matter of, when it comes to poverty, it's a matter of human rights. But I was, I loved Dr. King even more when I realized that he was not, like the the average preacher. It was a nice church, anniversaries every year, a Cadillac.
Right.
And look at me. But when this brother decided to pick up poor peoples of every ethnicity, beginning in Marks, Mississippi, and his brother said he was so excited because he said, "Yeah, we're going to take a mule train to Washington with nothing but poor people. And
right.
I said to myself, with this man's prestige and his popularity, he has time enough to really think about poor people. And then I said, oh, this brother is really going to bring threats upon him when he's the only one, Mr. Davis, that I've ever heard him speak nationally about this nation going through a redistribution of wealth.
Right.
Right. I'm sure that shook up a lot of, you know, the politicians others who and that you should stick with civil rights, because at that time he was really speaking against the Vietnam War, you know, against the president.
That's right.
But when
that's
this nation is going to have to go through a redistribution of wealth. I said, that's my man.
When he got to talking about the economics, that shook the very foundation of this country. And it was too many interests that would have been highlighted, or the spotlight would have been on, for lack of a better word, to show the hypocrisy, which is the same thing we do. I mean, it's happening right now today. They holler the 1%. Well, we know the 1% is making money like they never made before. Stock market is hitting numbers they've never seen before. But at the same time, poverty is going up. The prison counts are going up. The failed schools are going up. Unemployment is going up. So we're at the same place that we were just in the 20th century. We're in the same place we were in 1919. Violence against us, violence committed in our communities, and on top of that, you got a pandemic. What's
your... Yeah.
We hold up,
wow,
you know, individual symbols of success. Of course, we got an Oprah, we got a Bill Cosby, we got a LeBron, we got a Kobe, we got a Michael Jordan. Yeah, those are individual success stories. But as a people,
okay,
as a people, where are we at?
You're talking about
the Irish came over to America. It was just a poor. Excuse me.
What was that now?
I said the Irish, they came to America, they were very poor.
Right.
The Chinese, the Japanese, every people. But they have a network in place. I'll give you an example of some history here in Chicago. In that 1919 summer, Red Summer in Chicago, it started because 31st Street Beach on Lake Michigan was a dividing line. And there was a brother that went across that line. And they beat him to death out there and drowned him in Lake Michigan. But the group of individuals that perpetrated that came from Bridgeport, which is the most powerful political ward in the city of Chicago. But see, it was a gang of ruffians. It was a gang of ruffians. They called themselves the Hamburgers, Irish guys. They called themselves the Hamburgers. But you had the Irish politicians that came around them and said, listen, we're going to show you how to direct that energy, okay, into politics. First off, change your name from the Hamburgers to the Hamburg Social Club. And go out into your community and register, because once you register people, then they're going to vote. And vote the way you want them to vote. Now, the president of that Hamburg Social Club was a man by the name of Richard J. Daley, who just 30, 40 years later, 1955, became the mayor of the city of Chicago and created one of the most powerful Democratic machines in this country, the Cook County Democratic machine, who to this day still holds sway on power, not in, only in this city, but throughout this country. So it's the same little mentality, the same hamburgers. You got the so-called black gangs and black ruffians today. But our politicians that are supposed to work for the people, as opposed to them going back into their community and trying to create ways to bring our people into the system, they use the white politicians and the power structure use our youth as a litmus test. Well, if you're dealing with them, we're not going to deal with you. Well, then that breaks the chain of productivity. We've got to have leaders that are bold enough. Like Dr. King said, ain't nothing wrong with going to jail. What you going to jail for? You know what I'm saying? We wear that as a badge of honor, because that means he was out there in the struggle. So, you know.
Last time we had this conversation, I've got two questions to ask you. First, it was when Dr. King chose to go to Chicago and see about the living conditions. You know the story, because he even lived in a dilapidated three-bedroom apartment, and he paid $92 for three bedrooms and in whites only area, they got four bedrooms and they only paying $82. They had several meetings with Mayor Daley, and I got that documentary. Many of the leading community leaders also joined in the roundtable discussions about the improvement of those slums and the poor living conditions of those tenants. This question, and I don't know what you answered. I'm sure you answered it for me, but I've got to ask you again. What was really the results of all of those meetings, and with Dr. King being there, what was the outcome of those meetings in terms of the consideration of improving those living conditions of those poor people who didn't have heat, rats, infected tenants, biting babies, and everything? What was the outcome of that? You know.
Well, Chicago went on a major, what do they call it, affordable housing, what we all know as project. You know, they went to building projects all over the city. And it wasn't so much to provide better housing. It was more so designed to control the black vote, because now we got them all where we want them at. You follow what I'm saying? And our politicians were co-opted after Dr. King. See, Dr. King held such a high standard that you couldn't be around him and be talking out both sides of your neck. But once Dr. King left,
That's why Johnson, probably cutting you off. But that's one guest on the show said that Johnson, really, he was, one of the greatest politicians in terms of moving politicians around like checkers. Shoot, he liked to deal. He said he couldn't move Marvin. He couldn't move Martin King around.
And see that was to our downfall, as far as the politicians that didn't hold themselves to that same standard, because everybody say that the lifeblood of politics is money, but it's not. Money is what corrupts it. People are the ones that's the power, the lifeblood. Harold Washington gave us a great example of that in Chicago back in 1983. You know, he was fighting the Cook County Democratic machine. That was the Goliath. But Harold said, if my people, black, white, Hispanic, people that won't change, if you're willing to go out, I think it was 250,000. He said, well, we can register 250,000 new voters. He said, and I'll run for the mayor of Chicago, and I'll show you that that money is not going to mean anything. It's people. Once you put them new voters on the rolls, it became a movement. And a machine can't stand up to a movement. It's like today, the youth across this country, they got a taste of their power, albeit it was the wrong way, but they saw the power of them getting together. It's our job to redirect that energy into the voting booth as the elders. It's our chance now to say, okay, because I've said it for years, what in the world is this generation about? They have no cause. They're just running through the streets willy-nilly. What's going to unite them? Well, the same thing that united us in the 60s, the same thing that united our people in the 1919, is the conditions that we've been living in. Now we have to be sharp enough to say, okay, to the voter registration. We've got to take voter registration people. It's like they're walking during the census. We need to have people in all across the country walking through these communities, signing up these 18-year-old Hispanics and African-Americans, because that's the only way we're going to make change. Okay. We keep trying to reinvent the wheel. Dr. King say, hit them in the pocketbook. Organize to get the right to vote. Once you get the right to vote, you can put people in office. Once you get people in office, then you can change legislation. It's simple. But we're trying to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah. And when I was speaking at the museum here in Anaheim about our stories, Tougaloo 9, and they had a question and answer period, and a gentleman stood up and said, well, you know, Mr. Jackson, you know, we still are dealing with racism and inequality, and what are your thoughts about how can we change police brutality? And I think at that time, some white supremacists met with some citizens of Anaheim in the park, and one of the white supremacists had a flag, and stabbed one of the citizens in Anaheim with the pointed end of the flagpole. But the only thing, Mr. Davis, that I could really come up with in terms to bring about social change, to bring about the change of the social and political order of this country, I just said, well, we've got to vote. It's a ballot. We have got to vote and step into that voting booth and vote. You know, I couldn't really think of anything else but that.
Country is still one man, one vote. All we got to do is get out there and organize the youth. Because, see, the youth are like an untapped reservoir, just sitting there. That's all our political power, sitting there. But we got to direct them in the right direction. We got to get them to understand that there's more opportunities than a basketball player trying to be a rapper. You can be a doctor, a psychiatrist, psychologist, engineer, anything easier than you can trying to be the next rap star or the next Michael Jordan. It's just not going to happen. Those are once-in-a-lifetime guys. Well, we got to, you know, we got to keep turning out these students, man. You know, we've been working on that in Chicago for about the last 5 years with Infinite Scholars. And we provide one of the only college scholarships where we're not asking for a registration fee or you got to pay this. No, do a 250-word essay. Have at least a 2.5 GPA, and then come on down and get you a scholarship. We're trying to send 10,000 youth out of Chicago with a scholarship with the hope that we get them 10,000 coming back to serve their community.
Wow. Now, the other question I have for you, how did you become a part of the original Poor People's Campaign poor people riding in mule trains on up to Washington? How did you get involved in that, man, in 68, man?
Well, Dr. King had first came to Chicago in 66 with the fair housing agenda. And he organized the youth in this town. Because a lot of established ministers and a lot of established so-called black businessmen, you know, Dr. King met a lot of resistance coming to Chicago. Because everybody was being fed by the Cook County Democratic machine.
Right.
He met a lot of opposition. So he said, I'm going to the people. He went to the youth. And we marched up in that Soldier Field. And we marched up there in Resurrection City. And Dr. King had the youth from Chicago actually doing the security for Washington, for the Resurrection City. Now, after Dr. King left, we took that seed that he planted. And the youth in Chicago, what we did was got together and we shut down every major construction site in the city. We stopped the University from Illinois being built. All this was put together under a program called LSD in Chicago. And that was all of the youth from all over the city. We shut down all major construction. We had to even go to battle with the union.
How old were you, Mr. Davis?
At those times, I was 14, 15 years old, 16. Wasn't even old enough to go get a job at the union. But we were trying to fight for an old man down the street. They wasn't going to come out there and fight, but we had to go out there and fight. So, in 1970, the city of Chicago and the Building Trade Union signed an agreement with the youth of Chicago. C.T. Vivian sat there. Jesse was there and said that what we're going to do is bring in 4,000 youth into the trade unions immediately. And then every month after that, we got a quota that we're bringing in. Okay? Well, by the end of 1970, it was signed in January. By the end of 1970, all of the youth leaders that had put that program together were targeted and either murdered or locked up in the penitentiary.
Oh, no.
Then they slipped the drugs in there. See, after that, then the drugs came in. So you got to remember, 68, 69, everybody was talking black power, nationalism, combat boots and fatigues. And then the media played such a big role. They started telling us about Superfly and Hell Up in Harlem, and we went from combat boots to platform shoes. You know what I mean? And we lost sight. Went back to process. We went back to putting process in there. So just stay quick. The media plays a very important role. And they did that with this generation, the same thing. The rap music, it came out on the East Coast, Poor Righteous Teachers, A Tribe Called Quest. They was all talking about culture and dashiki. They was wearing dashikis and putting the picks in their head like we used to. But the recording industry and the record companies, they stopped promoting that knowledge rap. And they went to the West Coast and put all the money behind. the gangster rap.
Right.
Gangster rap.
Yeah.
So you had another generation that followed the Pied Piper right onto that same Superfly mentality all over again.
Right.
We fighting a force, man. We fighting a force that we got to realize what we fighting against.
Yeah, well, you're right. And so were you a part of the Poor People's Campaign, the one that was on their way to Washington? Were you in the role of a security staff member?
That was our role.
Was
to provide security. That was our group. The Youth from Chicago was to provide security. The same groups that 2 years later went together to shut down the construction sites in the city of Chicago. The same youth. Same
exact
youth. Wow. So, I mean, you know, it's no accident that, you know, we see, when you see that raw commitment from some of the men that were there with Dr. King, when you saw that, it's kind of hard for you to walk away from that and say, well, that was kind of exciting. But no, they gave you a lesson. They gave you a tool. They gave you instructions to elevate your people with. The thing is, we all got divided. And once we got divided,
what were you when you heard Dr. King had been assassinated on April 4th? Were you in, were you on the trail? You was on your way to Washington?
We were in Chicago.
Or where were you?
No. We were in Chicago when Dr. King was assassinated. April 4th, 1968. We were walking the streets of the south side of Chicago trying to stop the kids in the community from burning down our own community. The south side of Chicago was spared from a lot of the looting and the violence because we went to the streets and we said, why burn down your own neighborhood? Why burn it down? And we challenged the Cook County Democratic machine. In the 1968 presidential election, we went throughout the community, black community, and said, don't vote. Don't give your vote away to the Democratic Party. What are you getting out of it? We keep passing down that Democratic thing like a family heirloom. You got to be a Democrat. You got to be a Democrat.
Yeah.
You'll never have power as a people if you're not parlaying your resources. As long as the Republicans understand now that they get no support from our community, they're not going to give us any support. And this ain't the same Republican Party. This ain't the same one of the past. Nah, definitely. This is Trump. This is Trump's Republican Party now. And that's just a ball of confusion.
Yeah. So, while you were in Washington, at security, do you recall Dr. Ralph Abernathy and some other leading voices? Remember him going to Congress and bringing the plight of the poor, information, the proposal, or any kind of.
Well, again, you know, at that time I was 14. At that time I was 14 to 15. A lot of the larger issues, for lack of a better phrase, went over our head. But we understood that if we all together, we'll let them take the lead as long as we give them the support. If we give our elders the support, they're going to take us where we're trying to go. And that was our concern, give them the support. You know, we are the generation that grew up on watching Bull Connor put the dogs in the water holes on our people. And it was our position that we're not going to allow that. You're not going to do us like that.
Well, you see, Yeah, well, you know, me and my research assistant director, we are just completing listening to the audio book of my mentor, Mr. Medgar Wiley Evers, and we are going to honor him on his birthday, which is July the 2nd of this year, 2020. But in listening to this audio book, see, he was the first African-American field secretary of the NAACP in Mississippi. And and then when he saw the effects of bringing a change in the South with Bull Connors and Albany, Georgia, especially the Montgomery bus boycott as a result of direct action, he went to the executive director, Roy Wilkins, and he was saying, that I want to do what Dr. King is doing. As a matter of fact, Dr. King had him on his staff in 1957, working in an assistant executive capacity in his organization. And Roy Wilkins told Medgar, well, no, we don't want you really supporting another civil rights organization. But
right.
Medgar never really got over seeing the effects of Dr. King by way of direct action and the young people and all of that, as opposed to the NAACP wanting to settle civil rights matters legally, you know, in the courts.
Right.
And that's where we got involved because Medgar chose to violate the policies of the NAACP with regards to how they, in a very, very gradual way, trying to bring about a change in civil rights in the courts. Medgar said, no, I'm going to follow Dr. King's direction with regards to direct action. So he went to Tougaloo, Southern Christian College at the time that I was there. Tougaloo was a private Christian college, and he spoke with the president of that college and said, you know, I want some young people to get involved. You know what I mean? And so I'm paraphrasing,
right,
of course. But Dr. Beigel said, yeah, as long as whatever they do in terms of civil rights, as long as it, what they're doing remains within the law, go at it. You can organize it. And
yeah,
that's how Edgar in the spring of 61 organized the NAACP Youth Council, because he wanted young people. And out of the 15 or 20 members of the Youth Council, 9 of us were selected to stage that first reading. But it was obvious that by us really following the direct action approach, by walking into that library and then going to jail, Roy Wilkins really didn't like it, but he didn't really criticize Medgar for doing that, because Dr. King really had a big influence on Medgar in terms of direct action and using young people.
Right, right. Well, every organization, every function and job that the previous organizations did was all a step in the direction to get us where we're trying to go, and that's equality. You know, everybody fought a different fight. We all made progress from the time of Marcus Garvey on down. But we have to get back to the old time way of thinking. Stop trying to reinvent the wheel. This is a capitalistic society, and nothing hurts them more than when you tap into the resources, tap into them dollars. We're watching it today as Donald Trump opened up the country, and he know that this COVID virus is spreading like wildfire. But they're saying, forget about that. Forget about the ones that die. We've got to keep this economy going. So if we just get back one voice, if we get one agenda for African Americans in this country for the 21st century, and understand that that number one issue got to be economics. And there are so many branches that lead from that issue that we can uplift our people with. And one thing we mustn't leave out this time, we must not leave out international help. We must not cut ourselves off from Africa.
We must not leave out international help? Is that what you're saying?
We must not forget about the continent of Africa. That's our homeland. That's the international support. That's the international link that we've got to regroup. We've got to reconnect with families. We've got to do that.
You're absolutely right when you said we've got to return back to the old way of thinking. Because when you mentioned about, you know, the continent of Africa, when Medgar visited the various places in Africa, he visited Nairobi, Kenya, and Tanzania. But anyway, when he was there, he was really, really excited and was proud of the leadership of the Africans when they created the organization titled the United African Organization.
Okay. Right. Organization.
And when he
came back.
And when he came back to the States, he said, this is the way, really, that we are going to be able to become self-independent. And I'm going to create the United African American Organization of Unity. And that's when he then organized Mosque Inc. There in New York City. But that's what you were saying.
Right. Absolutely.
Medgar,
Got to reconnect ourselves back to the families of nations. There's only one place in the world you got niggas. That's in America.
Well, I was going to ask you, what you're saying is beautiful in terms of going back to the old landmark, as the song says, but how do you really able to gather like-minded African American people to unite without having the infiltration of the several times. And like Dr. King made in Chicago, how do you work around them?
We've got to address that through the educational system throughout this country. We've got to teach our kids of their glorious past. We've got to teach them about our culture. And then the generations as they come about, we're going to spark that curiosity. Now I want to see what Africa is like. I want to find out about Africa. But if all they're telling you your history goes as far back as Mississippi and Alabama in the antebellum times of slavery, I mean, that's not a memory that you're trying to cherish. But when you teach them about their glorious past, now you spark a new interest. You see, in this electrified age, men running around without knowledge of who they are, where they come from. But you can touch a button and you can contact and go all the way around the world, but you don't know who you are. That's what we have to address. We've got to address the school systems nationally so that they can teach a curriculum that will make African Americans proud of their past. And you teach them to be proud of the past. Now they've got a future.
Well, that's what my mentor, Medgar, did, you know, from listening to this audio book. When he returned from World War II back to Mississippi, the book said that Mississippi and its customs had not changed, but Medgar had, because
right.
when he was in the army in France, you know what I mean?
Right.
And he saw how he was treated with dignity, you know, in spite of some racial slurs from some soldiers, but overall, the people of France and Europe, you know, treated him with respect, and so it was no way that he would really return back to Mississippi the way he left. Am I right?
Absolutely. And I'm going to say this, because I've got another engagement I've got to get to, but if you can remember, when Richard Pryor went to Africa, he said, I went over to Africa. He said, I saw black people on money. I saw black pilots flying the planes. I saw black presidents, black heads of state. And he said, I will never call another black man a nigger. It changed him. Just as we talk about Malcolm, once you've got an insight into your past, then you can understand a little clearer about where you're going. And how are we going to ever have a generation of young African Americans to stand up and be proud of their African history when we start off teaching them about slavery? How many of our people really think Egypt is somewhere not in Africa? You follow what I'm saying? We have to understand.
Yeah. Well, we are at the end of our show, and you have really, really inspired me to continue on in doing what you're doing, and that is enlightening our people. And I thank you so much. And peace and blessings unto you and your family. And I am forever grateful for you for being a guest on the radio show, Voices of Wisdom.
Well, thank you for inviting me. And anytime, just let me know.
Yes, sir. Okay, then.
Thank
All
you.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Have a good evening.
Okay.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on Detroit from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
Tri-Family Channel. Tri-Family Channel.